Look for severe childhood disturbances associated with violence. Our Billy wasn't born a criminal, Paul. He was made one through years of systematic abuse. Billy hates his own identity, you see, and he thinks that makes him a podcaster. But his pathology is a thousand times more savage and more terrifying. Welcome, one and all, to the silence of the last knock. I am Johnny Lecter Numb, or Johnny the Cannibal. I don't know. It doesn't have the same ring to it. Nothing rhymes with Johnny, you know, so. In any case, I am one part of the hosting team for the Last Knock podcast, which is what you're listening to now. Joining me, as always, this evening is.
Billy, meh, crash, I'm the slaughtered lamb.
I love it, Silence of the Lambs, American Werewolf in London crossover that nobody asked for.
But they're gonna get it.
Absolutely, now they are.
Yeah.
And we are honored to
Damn
have
straight.
a long-time listener to the show, friend of the show, talented writer and filmmaker in his own right, Paul J. Williams.
Woo!
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good, how are you, man?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. Like Johnny just said, I've been with you guys since the beginning. Love the show. I listen every single week. You guys do a great job.
Don't
Oh,
make me
thanks,
cry.
Paul. But this show has been long in the making because Paul is going to serve as our subject matter expert on police procedure in horror films. And we're going to bring up some movies, maybe talk about some particular scenes and tropes that we've picked up on in watching horror movies that involve law enforcement. So it should be a pretty interesting conversation because I don't know that I've really heard anybody really talk about this subject with in any great detail.
No, we're
But
breaking
then
new ground, Johnny.
I was going to say always the innovators.
Yeah. What are we going to do for a show? I don't know. Let's get Paul on. Okay.
Oh, no. I'm your last hope. Oh my God.
That's what we're going to change the name of the podcast to, actually. Yeah. But before we get into it proper, since you're our guest tonight, Paul, and we have great respect for you, and obviously what you're going to bring to the conversation. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in law enforcement, if you feel comfortable, and your background as a screenwriter and filmmaker.
That's the whole
Sure.
show.
Yeah.
So I've been in law enforcement for over 20 years now. I've had a pretty unique, diverse career. I've been lucky in that regard. In terms of, I've done everything. I started as a street cop, Newark, New Jersey, and I've also worked for the federal government, U.S. Department of Justice, as a federal officer, and pretty much have done everything in between. I've got a chance to travel the world. So, yeah, it's been a long, strange journey. It's been a great career, it afforded me opportunities to see things I never would have seen. It's not always easy, not always the easiest job, but I love it, and I can't 20 some odd years went by in a flash. So in terms of writing, I really started writing seriously 2007, 2008,
Okay.
screenwriting. And then about 2010, 2011, I decided, no one or very few people are really going to be interested in making any of my scripts. So might as well try to do it myself. And since then, I've made a couple short films. They've made the festival route, they've been fairly well received. So I've had some good fortune with that as well. I love writing. I love movies. I've been a movie buff my entire life. Probably in some ways before even law enforcement or the idea of law enforcement entered my life, the idea of movies and writing was in my life, far before that. So they're two huge passions that I have.
Oh, that's awesome. And I was talking to Billy before the show. A couple years ago, you kickstarted Case 5930, mm-hmm. which you wrote and Billy actually directed, mm-hmm. and I was happy to be included as a part of that, and I donated to the Kickstarter. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And you know what I say it to Billy all the time. I think it's a great movie, and I'm not just saying that because I'm in it for 2 seconds. So.
Bill can attest. I'm sure he'll agree. It was that so many people, made that Kickstarter successful. Obviously, the movie would never have happened if it wasn't for folks like you. So we're so appreciative of that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also the notion of, I guess, low budget filmmaking, because it was like $5,000 through the Kickstarter, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just like watching the finished product, it was just a thrill to get the DVD in the mail and put it in and actually watch it. And I was, I was like, yep, my hopes and my hopes and dreams for the film and what you guys set out to accomplish were really affirmed by watching it. So,
thank you so much. I appreciate saying that.
Yeah, no problem. And Billy, do you want to say anything?
No, nope.
You've been kind of quiet.
No, you guys are talking. What am I going to do? No, I think
I could tell you a quick story that's horror related. How really Case 5930 became to be even as a screenplay.
Oh, please. Yeah.
So I know it's one of Bill's favorite movies, but I left the theater, I guess, 2009, having seen Paranormal Activity, and I was pretty mad. I did not like that movie. It has its qualities. I get it, but I was disappointed. And so I guess I'm at work. A couple days later, this is when I was still back in patrol, and I'm on patrol, and I happen to look up at the dash cam that's in all our police cars. And the idea just struck me about telling an entire story through that dash cam and making it better than Paranormal Activity. So, so in a weird way, a horror movie gave birth to Case 5930, because I don't know if it would have happened without me going to see Paranormal Activity. So,
well, that's there good. You go. That's good.
So you do owe Paranormal Activity a sort of debt for Case 5930.
You know what, Bill? We should have put something in the credits.
Yeah. Thanks, Oren Pelley. Yeah. But one of the cool things about doing that shoot was Paul had some of his colleagues on hand to teach the actors, how to stand, how to draw their weapon. What to do when somebody approaches them, to keep their gun side away from the person, which is something that you don't see in movies, whether horror or not. And, that's one, directing, that's what I wanted. I wanted this to be as accurate as possible, because once you have the realism, then, people, the audience buys into it more. So that was the beauty of that.
Yeah, and I think that segues nicely, Bill, into the reason we have Paul here tonight is because I think someone like me, who has, we've all watched movies our entire lives, but mm-hmm. The element of the fantastic in films, whether it's from Die Hard to The Shining or whatever, it's kind of you look at stuff and there are certain, I guess, leaps of faith you take that you trust the filmmaker if they're trying to tell a story maybe rooted in some kind of reality that, okay, they're going to try and get this somewhat true to how it might happen when in reality that might not be the case. And for someone like me who has like no real insights into, police procedure, and there are so many cop films out there and so many action thrillers, which I'm sure Paul just kind of rolls his eyes at.
Yeah. And real quick, you bring up Die Hard. I mean, I know it's ultimately a silly action movie. It's a good movie. It is a good movie. But so who's the officer that responds? Is it Powell? That was tactics back in the day. Now with how many tragedies since of hostage situations or active shooters, now cops are trained to enter the building and engage the shooter. Mm-hmm. Whereas really up until Columbine, the first responding officers were, you know, create a perimeter, lock the scene down, and you call in SWAT, which is exactly what Powell does in that movie. Not nowadays, you don't see that at all.
Okay.
But again, I understand that's it's not a, you know, not serious, not a serious movie. so I don't think they were too hung up on, you know, proper police procedure in Die Hard.
Yeah, I think Die Hard is definitely more a escapist, overblown action. So yeah, and on that level, it succeeds definitely.
Positive. Yep.
Well, I started the show off with a paraphrased quote from The Silence of the Lambs, and I know, Billy, we could argue over its status as a horror film, but
I could argue with you too.
Well, I mean, I feel like that was the first film that popped into my head as something that is often lumped in with the genre, that is really steeped in procedural details. And I wouldn't know where to start with that one, because, you know, you have Clarice Starling, who she's kind of a rookie sent on this kind of task that kind of rabbit trails down into these various, like, you know, she witnesses an autopsy, I believe, or she's in the morgue. She confers with the insane criminals. I mean, obviously you've seen the film, Paul.
Oh, of course, yes.
So I don't know if there's anything you'd like to pick apart as far as that film is concerned.
Do it, Paul. Go for it.
So I guess the genre of the film first, just to get it out of the way, I lean more towards it being a crime drama than a horror. And I totally understand why horror experts or horror fans want it to be a horror. And I even get some of the arguments, I do, but anyway, it's neither here nor there. So I guess it being from the point of view of the FBI, I've never worked for the FBI. I don't pretend to know what they do.
Okay.
But for the most part, the FBI really only come in unless it's a federal official that's killed or it's in federal jurisdiction. The FBI generally only come in as consultants. They're not primary investigators. Murder, for the most part, is a state crime. It's investigated at the local level. And I guess obviously in the instances of serial killings, the FBI is called in. I haven't seen the movie in a while. I mean, nothing really jumps to mind as being like completely out of the ordinary. I mean, at the end, her investigating this by herself when she goes to Buffalo Bill's house, I'm not sure that would happen. At a minimum, if she wouldn't have like local field agents with her, at a minimum, she would have the local PD on scene with her. Generally, when you're out there in plain clothes, you want to have a uniform or a marked car with you. But you know, you wouldn't be able to have the twist at the end then that she's actually at Buffalo Bill's house and not the other place. You know, spoiler alert.
I saw that twist coming, man. I saw that twist coming. I was like,
did you? I didn't see that coming. I didn't see it coming.
But
well, go ahead, Bill.
No, though, I'm glad you brought up federal, because a lot of people think, like, if something is federal, like a kidnapping, you know, I know FBI responds to kidnappings, right?
It goes back to, like, a very old statute, maybe from the 20s or 30s.
Shit.
Like, right, even before maybe, like, the Lindbergh killing, the Lindbergh baby death, where it was assumed that if there's a kidnapping, within 24 hours, state lines have been crossed, thus making it a federal offense. Even to this day, the FBI will still investigate that. Mm-hmm. But most of your local murder, a vast majority of it, it's investigated at the local or county level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure the FBI would be happy to consult on any murder, especially if all leads have everything's run dry, you know, and definitely in the instances of serial killing, or if they want some sort of, especially with criminal profiling. You know, they have experts. The FBI has experts in that, you know, resources that simply the local level does not have.
Well, and I think that was the thing with, if I'm recalling correctly, I feel like that was the thing with Silence of the Lambs. It's like the local law enforcement, they go from place to place kind of through the Midwest or whatever.
Yep.
And then they meet up with the local police, and the local police sort of give them access to where it is they're at, basically, sort of. So it is kind of like the local police have hit a wall, and or they're kind of stuck cooperating, because it's been determined that the feds need to come in and and take a look at things. Yeah.
And I've read almost all of John Douglas's book. He's the FBI agent that the Scott Glenn character is loosely based on.
Oh, okay.
And he writes that, I guess, you know, it becomes like a jurisdiction or us versus them every time the FBI is called in. And of course, the locals, you know, they're not receptive to it all the time. But I'm here to tell you, if I'm investigating any sort of serious crime, I'll take any help I can get. So, you know, I am not going to get involved in any sort of jurisdictional or power struggle with, you know, but I understand that being the case. I do.
Well, no, go ahead, man.
Well, without getting into it, you know, any specifics, Paul, have you ever found yourself in a situation like that where it's like some very big kind of thing that happened and you have to collaborate with another jurisdiction or it's...
Oh, for sure.
Okay. All right.
Maybe not so much on a federal level, but you're always working either with like the prosecutor's office or something, maybe the state police in my case, or working with just another local police department. Off the top of my head, I can't remember working, you know, with the FBI or any of the federal agencies. Not off the top of my head, but my memory is bad. So, but and fortunately, so fortunately, I have not. You know, I have not. So,
Paul, yesterday when you and I were at lunch, we talked about one of the things that I think bothers both of us the most is when a police officer in a film, any film, you know, shoot somebody. Mm-hmm. What we normally see in movies, this is why I love Dirty Harry so much. You know, he blows somebody away and he's walking down the street still with his, you know, 44 Magnum. And I'm like, he wouldn't have that gun anymore. It's like,
no,
that wouldn't be issued to him to begin with. But so what happens in reality if a police officer shoots somebody, you know?
Okay, so I mean, just speaking for here in New Jersey, and I'm sure the procedure is similar across the country. In cases of officer-involved shootings, your gun is immediately taken away. And normally, if the officer is physically injured, obviously they're going to be taken to the hospital. But it's even common practice to take the officer directly to the hospital, even for a psychological evaluation. And then that officer is generally placed on administrative leave. All police shootings here in New Jersey are investigated by the Attorney General's office, the shooting response team. And if it was part of any sort of like investigation, ongoing investigation, I can guarantee you that officer is no longer going to be involved with the investigation. So if that was our protagonist, you know, obviously that's not going to work if we remove them from Act Two because they shot somebody. So that's why movies continue to have them in there till the end. And you can understand, like, everything I just said is completely boring, and that's real life, because real life can be boring, and that's what would happen. But it's a lot more dramatic, or it works more for the story if you're a protagonist, or if you have characters that get involved in a shooting and they're right back out there the next day, you know, doing their thing. So, mm-hmm. but that is the long and short of it. That is the procedure.
And every TV show, every cop show is like, should be off the air then.
Oh, I mean, if you were gonna make any sort of TV show or movie with police procedure in it, I mean, you just wouldn't be able to do it. If you're gonna do it the proper way, I mean, you just no one would watch it. You wouldn't want to do it. There's a saying in law enforcement. I mean, I can't take credit for it, but law enforcement, whether you're in on the patrol level or even the investigative angle, it's long periods of boredom interrupted by short periods of brief excitement. And the excitement might be dramatic, it might be life-threatening, but you know, you can't make a movie like that. You can't make a movie of long periods of boredom. You know, you might be investigating something for a year, you finally get information on a suspect, you hit the house. I mean, maybe it takes 10 minutes to hit the house and lock the guy up. It's 10 exciting minutes out of a 12-month investigation that, you know, so you can't, and how could you make a TV show or a movie around that? You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's hard.
Paul, I beg to differ because you are a huge fan of The Wire, and you have even said that that is a that show is. It might not have been you who said that, but I believe someone said that it's about as accurate as you could get as far as the politics and the politics of just being police in a city like Baltimore, the school system, the politics, for sure. How everything sort of commingles and everything.
Oh, positively. I mean, having worked for the city of Newark and for the police department, so knowing like how a U.S. urban city with a high crime rate operates, it's very, very, very similar to what you see in The Wire, in the Baltimore City Police Department. The Comstat meetings, just the minutia and the red tape of government at the municipal, at the city level. The Wire had, I think it's, is it, Edward Burns? He was a, Baltimore City detective that wrote on the show. And obviously David Simon, was a, you know, Baltimore reporter. So they had intimate knowledge. I mean, they had lived what Baltimore goes through. They weren't writing this from, you know, California. So, you know what I mean? Like they knew, they knew the ins and outs of the city of Baltimore. And, it's very accurate. It's definitely what I experienced.
Yeah, something that I was really taken with on that show, and I know this is a tangent, but
here we go.
What was the fact that it took me about 3 episodes to like get with the rhythm of it. Actually, me and my girlfriend were considering quitting on the show, but we kept with it, and then it really picked up once we discovered that I think we had to calibrate our expectations to the fact that, okay, this isn't Hollywood police, you know, this isn't a Hollywood police procedural. It's not a network TV police procedural. And to your point, Paul, about the boredom of the job, you know, I think that's probably why, I mean, The Wire is a fascinating show. The characters are great. The writing is great. And that's something Billy and I know, and you obviously gravitate towards. And, But the thing is, that show was threatened with cancellation several times, and they struggled to keep making it and seeing it through to its end ultimately because the ratings were so low, and that might have been because the audience was not there, because maybe the audience was more looking for, well, we want more something that's more like the Point Break or something like that.
I agree. It's definitely a show that is appreciated, you know, after it's ended. And I'm so glad that those guys stuck to their guns and kept their integrity and didn't cave into
crap,
a crime drama that we normally would see. And they do a very good job of showing the minutia. They have scenes up in the homicide unit of the detective sleeping at their desk. And you might say, oh, there's lazy city cops doing nothing. But that really goes to show you, like, even in a homicide, if all the leads run out and you have nothing to go on, you're literally just sitting there waiting for the next, you know, all those scenes they have when the phone rings because they know it's the next homicide coming in. Once all leads are exhausted and you have nothing else to go on, the case does run cold. I mean, it is unfortunate. And you sit there waiting for the next job to come in, and maybe, you know, there's the scene where the guy's praying for it to be a domestic violence where the husband's still on scene, so they just... lock them up, and not a classic whodunit, you know, is the phrase that they use. And it, you know, so they do portray that, and that is a reality of the job. It's an unfortunate reality of the job.
You know, the other show that I really loved was Homicide: Life on the Streets, which also took place in Baltimore, because they would do the same thing. You'd have your homicide detectives, and you might not see a detective for 3 episodes because they were, you know, they were, you know, they shot somebody, so they're off, you know, so they're home. Mm-hmm. So they would go to somebody else on another story. And that's what I loved about it. You know, it was always active, but you got to see that reality, you know, which I really enjoyed.
What is unique about The Wire is none of those main characters ever fire their weapon on the show.
Mm-hmm.
The one character, the female character, I can't remember her name.
Kima.
Yeah, she obviously gets shot in that scene, but, you know, that is just she gets ambushed. So, I mean, how many crime dramas, especially TV shows that ran 5 or 6 seasons, can you say that, you know, none of the main characters fired their weapon? I mean, it just, you know, but...
Which is the norm, right? I mean, I know police officers, like, they retired and they never even drew their firearm.
I would think outside of in Baltimore, it's rare. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
In Baltimore, I would think it's rare for one of those characters to be that far in their career. Well, I mean, we don't know if they shot anybody when they were in patrol. I mean, just when we mm-hmm. observed those characters, that's very accurate. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad they made that choice. I mean, this job is, it is rare for a shooting or it is, you know, that there is more to this job that they can show than just the shooting. There is lots of drama to this job that they can show that's not, you know, a shooting, and The Wire does it perfectly.
Mm.
Well, I was going to say, to segue back into horror a bit, Paul, you were talking about the detectives sleeping at their desks and the leads running out and the case going cold. A movie I know both, actually all three of us, really have a lot of admiration for is the Dowdle Brothers, the Poughkeepsie Tapes.
Oh, yeah.
what do you think of that film? Because I know you think highly of it. And how does that stack up as far as, I guess, its approach and its towards police procedure?
Speaking of the Dowdle Brothers, they did the Waco series that's currently on. I'm in the middle of watching that.
Holy shit! I didn't know that. I really gotta watch that now.
I was surprised when I saw their names popped up because this was like a little bit different for them. So I was surprised and I was happy to see their names pop up. So I only saw the movie once, maybe 2008 or 2009.
Oh shit! Okay.
It's a difficult. I wrote once before. I forget where, but I mean, it's one of the only movies that lives up to everything you've heard. And how many movies can you say that do that? Like, it lives up to the hype. Yeah. It is pretty crazy stuff. And everything I've read about the Dowdle brothers, they're fairly normal people. They're fairly, so where that came from, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like the specific police procedure. Like I said, I only watched it once and it was a long time ago. Nothing jumps to mind as being, I know, spoiler alert, I know towards the end, doesn't their investigation get diverted because of 9/11? Doesn't that come at the end? That's why I remember that being like a plot point.
That could be that it might be actually.
I can't recall. Yeah, but I think you're right. Something did happen.
I think not, because obviously Poughkeepsie, New York, it's outside of New York City.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think 9/11 happens, and that sort of, you know, either puts the investigation on the back burner or diverts. Which is probably true. I mean, think about how many, maybe not serial killing investigations, but how many serious investigations do you think, you know, were either ended or, you know, or paused mm-hmm. because of 9/11? You know what I mean? Like in the New York City area, I mean, all the resources had to be drained to deal with that. So, I mean, that's fairly accurate. I can't think of anything like specific that jumped to mind when I watched the movie, you know.
Well, I know. I think I had a question. I think when Billy and I did the show on the Poughkeepsie tapes, and maybe you might be able to speak to this. One of the things that bothered me, I thought it was a strong movie. Don't get me wrong, but one of the interview subjects was titled a dismemberment expert,
yes.
And I thought that was, and I was like wondering immediately, is that an actual thing, or did they just make it up for the movie?
They made it up for the movie. I mean, here in New Jersey, we have medical examiners, and they're very knowledgeable, they're very experienced, and they would know, you know, the cause of death, the manner of death, post-mortem, dismemberment. They would know all that. Do they exist in the world, these dismemberment experts? I'm sure, but I would feel confident with the medical examiner being able to determine what happened pre-mortem, post-mortem, you know. But it sounds cool for a movie like that, is what the case is.
Well, one of the things I noticed with reality shows recently, I'm actually glad you brought that up, Johnny, was they'll put a tag like they did in the Poughkeepsie tapes of like declaring somebody an expert of something bizarre that there's no certification for or anything like that. And I can't think of anything offhand, but I know recently I came across something where they said that somebody was a crystal therapy expert. And, you know, that person, you know, would normally be, you know, a Wiccan, and, you know, that's something that they would do. But as far as I know, there's no certification for it. There's no classes. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, whether it's, you know, viable or not. But, you know, for a show, that's what they used. And, you know, just to make it clear to the audience and, like, cement, you know, where the audience was at, what this person was doing. So I could see any, you know, usually reality TV shows do crap like that, you know. They throw up, like, some sort of expert name.
Well, Bill, title. If you've seen Paradise Lost, the documentary series about the West Memphis Three.
Oh, God, it, yeah.
Well, they bring in an expert who claims to be an expert in just that, in the occult. Okay. And dealing with the Wicca, Wiccan, and it turns out like he's obviously an expert for the state, and the defense attorneys rip him apart. It turns out like he got his PhD through the mail. He barely and he turns out to really not be an expert at all, and that was back in what, 94, and. But I guarantee it to this day, I mean, especially now, you could be an expert in whatever niche part of, you know, a crime that the occult or Satanism or somebody out there can claim to be an expert. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, I don't think there's any, like, official certification and stuff, but really anybody can run around and say that they're an expert. You know, it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
So, but that's a big part of that case. How those kids got convicted.
Wow. Jeez, man.
Well, Paul, I had some, I guess, tropes that I see sometimes in movies, and it could be pulled from. Actually, have you seen I Saw the Devil, Paul?
The Asian film? South Korean film?
Oh, no, then I did not know.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe I can... This doesn't give anything away about the film because it's a huge part of it and it's established within the first couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. I guess, what are your feelings about maybe, and I mean, this goes into exploitation territory as well. Like Bill was mentioning the Dirty Harrys, you know, you've got you've got the Death Wishes, you've got the films that sort of look to mind thrills from the notions of vigilantism, kind of like unchecked vigilantism. What are your feelings on that, I guess, as a police officer?
The rogue cop, is that what you're talking about, Johnny?
Yeah, that's cliche, yeah.
Magnum Force.
Okay, so you mean the police officer being like serving almost as like a vigilante.
Okay, yeah, and actually, you know what, I rewatched a Gangster Squad last night, something like that, where it's like, you know... It's like that movie obviously took a lot of liberties with what actually happened in the, you know, commissioning of police to bring down the mob kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking from like a law enforcement perspective about being maybe becoming a vigilante because the criminal justice system didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Right.
That's definitely something you probably see more in movies than in real life, especially in today's world. Mm-hmm. But again, it makes for a great movie, right? I mean, it makes for a great setup, a great character. I don't see that being a reality in today's world. Again, it makes for a great movie. I don't see that in the world we live in now with all the consequences, all the ways to get caught. It's not really worth it. I think cops almost at some point they come to realize the criminal justice system at times can only do so much. I think that's a reality you learn with the job. I don't see it being a reality. I don't see a rogue cop or a group of rogue cops going out there after the fact seeking the guy out and administering street justice. I don't see it being a thing.
You know, it's like it's
not
like
in general.
Yeah, it's like Johnny was really hoping for that. Yeah, there's rogue cops protecting us. But
yeah,
I know Paul. When you when your shift's over, I know you usually don a cape and a mask, and you know, I know you do your thing separately as a superhero. So that's cool.
Right.
But
Billy, bring up a good point. I mean, that's something. He's like, it's a Batman type of thing. It's not a reality. You know what I mean?
Hey Paul, since you haven't seen it, I would definitely recommend checking out I Saw the Devil.
I am writing it down as we speak.
It's a 4.5 out of 5 for me.
Wow, man. I had issues.
And I would
with
be actually yeah, I'd be interested to get your your perspective on it, because I believe that's just a, if I'm remembering correctly, Bill, he's just like a he might be a, some sort of quote unquote special cop. But
yeah, whatever. But I had major issues with the story because of what the cop was allowing to occur, which was just ridiculous. But Paul, how about go ahead.
Sorry, Bill, not to cut you off, but there we're seeing more now in the last, I would say, 5 years. With the phenomenon of false confessions, and Netflix actually has a pretty good documentary about it. And I guess it kind of ties into what you're saying about maybe like cops maybe being like a little bit more aggressive than they should be in interrogation situations, to where people, at least at the moment that they think are guilty of this crime. I'm not talking about beating people or anything like that, but definitely using methods and techniques that, you know, in hindsight are now being either frowned upon or completely done away with. Mm-hmm. There's probably that. There's probably maybe police officers being a little overzealous in terms of that. I mean, and we see that in the West Memphis 3 as well, where you're keeping either juveniles or people that are mentally diminished, you know, for 12, 18 hours. You're keeping them up. You're not feeding them or you know, obviously they're not sleeping. So we are seeing that being exposed a little bit. So maybe that could be tied into what you're saying a little bit, you know, a cop going a little bit above and beyond trying to get a confession. We are seeing that, at least it's being exposed. But again, especially like when the cop thinks that the person that he's talking to is guilty, they want the case adjudicated. They want the arrest. They want the person brought to justice. They want, you know, the victim to have, you know, closure. So, Not defending what has happened, but, you know, just trying to explain it a little bit. So.
And they get blinders on because they're focused on only one element and, you know, or one person when it could be something else. Right. Yeah.
Especially, and then, again, like, not to keep on going back to the West Memphis 3, I mean, but that was definitely the case of blinders. Mm-hmm. I mean, they zeroed in on these three kids, and they left really, you know, in hindsight, 2020. This was a different time and a different place. When these guys were doing what they were doing, but they zeroed in on three people and really left no other option for any other suspects.
Yeah,
and you know, we see what happens. So,
well, I mean, that's a real life horror story right there.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Very good trilogy to check out too, if you haven't.
Yeah, it's a fascinating series of documentaries.
Just incredible. Just incredible.
Paul, I mean, quite often we see, I remember, I mean, I didn't, you know, I didn't become a cop or anything like that. I didn't finish my training, but I remember the one vice officer was like, anybody on our unit, I always tell the guys, if you draw your weapon, you better use it. Otherwise, just keep it in your holster. And I remember in training, the only time we were supposed to take it out was when we were approaching a vehicle, keep it by our side and go along the side just in case. But other than that, so many times we see in any film where a police officer is approaching a house, even to ask questions, someone has like their gun out or something like, and I don't see that anywhere. I mean, I just saw an arrest two blocks from me. I don't know what this guy did. Cops all over the place, and like there was nothing. Nobody, you know, it was just like, hey, come here. You know, it's like one of those deals. You know, no guns drawn, nothing happened, and you know, it was just. I don't know. It's just
I think the situation obviously dictates what your response should be. Mm-hmm. If you're stopping a car, what I'm assuming is just like a routine motor vehicle stop, and you have your gun out every single time, you're probably doing something wrong, or you know, your actions need to be looked at. You should not be. It's one of the most dangerous things that a police officer does is the motor vehicle stop, of course. But it should not be something that you have your gun out at every time.
I had that happen to me.
A cop had a gun out.
Oh yeah, man! I never gripped that steering wheel so hard in my life, man. I was like, holy shit! And that was how I was taught in the academy. I won't mention the academy name. It's like you have your gun out, you slink along the side, and I'm like, and that never happened before. And this cop's doing it, and I was like, "Oh shit!" You know, it's just like,
yeah. I guess that was training, you know, back in the day. I could tell you, boy. I don't go back as far as that, but I mean, I'm telling you, as someone who worked the 4th Precinct on midnights in Newark, New Jersey, I didn't have my gun out, you know, every single motor vehicle stop every person I encounter. You just wouldn't be able to do your job. Operating like that. I mean, I like to say in the law enforcement mind, like, you know, common sense prevails, you would hope.
Right.
I always tell younger guys, and it's easier said than done, but at some point you have to develop a sixth sense about people. Because if you're going to operate, if you're going to operate treating everybody the exact same, thinking that every person that you encounter is a criminal, and have your gun out, or, I mean, you always have your guard up maybe, but you can't be running around with your gun out. So if you're 5-10 years on the job and you're still pulling your gun out routinely, maybe definitely in like suburbs or rural environment, definitely not. I mean, maybe in some of your more high crime areas, I could see it, you know, maybe a little more, but even that is questionable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Common sense prevails. You're not going to be able to be a police officer in 2018 United States with your gun out all the time. It's just not going to happen, you know.
Bill, it was the cop from the end of Your Next, admit it.
Oh, God. Please, man, don't even bring that up. But that, you know, Paul, like, you know, can you recall off the top of your head any horror movies that got police procedure right?
I don't know,
Absentia maybe or something like that?
I'm trying, like, I give a lot of leeway to movies. I do.
Don't do it, Paul.
Because I have to. I would never be, especially the movies that I enjoy, you know, crime or horror or thrillers, you know, more times than not, there's going to be a law enforcement present in the movie.
Yeah.
So I definitely let a lot go. I would not be able to enjoy a single movie if I was going to critique police procedure. I mean, there's the age old movie trope of like the cop never running out of bullets in a shootout.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll still see that every now and again. So some movies are pretty good with it, you know, but the endless amount of ammunition, obviously that bothers me.
Yeah.
But no, nothing really jumps out. When it comes to like investigative or detective movies, unless it's like a serial killing, most cops, even like a homicide detective, are going to carry multiple cases at a time.
Right.
But when we see like detective movies, they're only working on the one case.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you right now, a homicide detective in Newark right now might be carrying 10 to 15 cases. And you know, but when we see these homicide detectives in movies, they're always working on what, one case.
Yeah.
Yep. And you know, because why? Because it would be boring to see them work on their 8 other cases. And, you know, but like I said, you know, so if you want to like take Seven, for example.
Yes.
Obviously at some point, Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, when they determine this is obviously a serial killing, yes, that's going to be the only case they work on. They probably will develop a task force to work on with them. But, you know, with the city that they worked in, this violent city that they worked in, you know, before those killings happened, those guys are probably juggling 10 to 15 cases.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see that a lot in movies. Like people think, especially in the homicide, for homicide detectives, that it's just, you know, one case, one murder, you take until it's solved, and that's definitely not the case. You know?
Yeah.
You know, any detective is juggling numerous cases at any time, no matter what they're investigating.
Not to interrupt, Paul, but I was going to bring up Seven, and I was, I guess, just on a general, I guess, high level overview of that film. I know it's definitely taking place in its own fantastic, ultra bleak, you know, nothing good can happen kind of world.
Mm-hmm.
The city doesn't even have a name, you know, but
it is a nameless city. Is it supposed to be Seattle? Maybe, I don't know, because then they're in the desert later on. But no, it's a nameless city. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's raining every day up until
he gets caught.
Up until the end, and
turns himself in.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know a lot is exaggerated, and Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote the script, I mean, he's a good writer, I think. But I mean, obviously that film was written with a definite lean toward the fantastic, maybe. But did you think it got details of police procedural right? I know there's the whole scene where they find the fingerprints, or they're using the luminol to decode a message that's been thumbprinted onto a wall. Details like that.
So with Seven, first off, with Seven, it's one of the best screenplays in that genre ever written. It is one of my favorite movies. It's almost the perfect movie in some ways.
It shot so well, my God.
I love the last 20 minutes where they're just in the car talking back and forth. That's some brilliant stuff you don't see in movies very often.
And it's incredible, and it plays so well. Like, there would be that cop, that cocky, although we do root for him. We do sympathize with the Brad Pitt character. Mm-hmm. There is that cop that would want to taunt the guy, go back and forth with the guy, you know, and it's portrayed so well there. And what's so unique with that movie, can you think of another crime drama or another movie like that where they know who the guy is, but he turns himself in?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, can you think? I can't think off the top of my head. I can't think of another movie where, you know, he surrenders to him. God knows if they ever would have caught him, you know?
Mm.
But in the sense of, like, where, again, like, so when they determine, when the brilliant Morgan Freeman determines that this is a, you know, series of serial killings based upon the seven deadly sins, yes, this would be the only case that they worked on. And they would probably have a team of people working with them. Mm-hmm. And just the sense of how the case takes on your life. You know, Brad Pitt barely gets home to see Gwyneth Paltrow anymore. And yeah, so just how the case takes over your life. I mean, you'd be working 12, 16-hour days. I love the scene where they're going back and forth about getting a search warrant for his apartment.
Yeah.
Guys, let me tell you that would happen. That would happen. I mean, in New Jersey, you could probably say, well, there's exigent circumstances because it's an ongoing investigation. There might be civilians that are either at risk or will be at risk. So maybe the search warrant requirement for that search would be, lifted. But I love that whole scene's great when Brad Pitt, he pretends to give in to Morgan Freeman, and he busts his door open anyway. It has happened. I can guarantee you it. And those type of investigations, I can guarantee it happened.
What about that moment, like right after Brad Pitt does it, where they cut to the alleyway where he's mm-hmm. feeding lines to, I guess, this homeless woman to tell the beat cop, I guess, like, oh yeah, there was this suspicious activity going on and some weird shit happening.
Well, Johnny, so you know what that makes him, Johnny? A good cop.
Yeah, okay.
I can't condone what he does, but that is being a good cop. You know, sometimes the ends justify the means, and that's, you know. And it's a quick – I know exactly the moment you're talking about, and that is a quick moment that adds authenticity to the story, mm-hmm. yet it's still entertaining, and – It works. It's a great little moment there.
Yeah,
Paul. You know, because you write screenplays and all, and you've written crime dramas. You're working on another one now. Your first feature film is in pre-production.
Yep.
What do you throw police procedure out the window on occasion?
Absolutely. The movie that you're talking about, the script that I wrote that's in pre-production now, it, no spoilers, but it ultimately involves an undercover police officer that completely defies any sort of law enforcement procedure or, you know. I mean, any screenplay that I have ever written that's in the crime genre, I try maybe as best as I can mm-hmm. to keep it authentic, but no, at the end of the day, no. I become every other writer. I do, you know.
Go ahead, Paul.
No, go ahead, Bill. You go ahead.
Okay. What advice would you have for somebody who wants to write a story, horror or otherwise, mm-hmm. that has police elements in it?
Okay. So in times in the past where I've consulted or just, you know, given advice to a friend, I always start with the preamble of within reason. don't let reality get in the way of telling your story. Again, within reason.
Right.
Because like I've said before, if you were to follow like proper police procedure throughout, you simply wouldn't be able to write a story, mm-hmm. your story, especially crime or a horror. I tell people now, like, I mean, there is a wealth of information out there now in the age that we're in now. I mean, a simple Google search could probably answer you know, there's how many law enforcement forums are there that you can pop a question up there, and mm-hmm. you know, within a day you get 50 responses.
Right.
And if you just call your local police department, cops love talking. They love, especially when they hear it's a writer. They love talking. You know, that's the preamble that I give. But then at the end, I tell them there's no excuse to get it, you know, as bad as some of these movies do get it. There's no excuse in the times we live in now with the information that's available to us. There's no excuse
right.
not to be able to at least be within reason, reality of what happens in a police procedural. There's so many forums. There's so many, you know.
Oh, yeah,
so
the avenues are endless.
Oh, my God. There's so many ways for you to get information. There's all you got to do is just do a little bit of research and you know, the answers will come to you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, I know you want to wind the show down, but I got to ask one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
And blame my podunk ignorance for this. But,
oh, boy. Here we go.
Well, you know what? I recently picked up the Criterion edition of Night of the Living Dead. And I've said to Billy and I've said on this show that it's probably my favorite horror film of all time. But
beat him and burn him.
Yep, uh-huh. Good shot. That's another one for the fire.
Oh, man.
One of the things that Romero kind of established was, I guess, his... I don't know that he's anti-authority, but he likes to toy with notions of martial law, which comes into play in the last act of that film when the police, I guess the local law enforcement, decide to take it upon themselves to sort of roam the countryside to do a clean sweep of the ghoul epidemic that's kind of sweeping Pittsburgh and other places. Now, I doubt that you've been involved with something like that, but how would that go about happening if that were to happen, like the declaration of martial law?
It's a good question. The only thing, I mean, we would have to be, I mean, you guys probably don't, I mean, we would have to be in a really bad way for mm-hmm. martial law to be declared. So I live in Central Jersey, and, you know,
I'm sorry to hear that.
it's the nicer part of Jersey.
Yeah, no, it is.
But so obviously 2012 Hurricane Sandy came through, and
yeah,
especially the Jersey Shore, you know, parts haven't recovered yet. So as far as like experiencing, because I'm not gonna say it was martial law, but look, mm-hmm. when we went out driving around and going to the store, it was pretty scary. It was pretty scary. And I mean, it would have to be something really bad, obviously, for martial law to be declared. And I think that would be law enforcement's absolute last resort. You know, we do not want people out there, you know, acting like the police or finding justice for themselves. Although I have to say because the power was out in the area I live mm-hmm. here, that the power was out for like 2 weeks. And without like the red lights or any of the signals, I think traffic moved smoothly, to be honest. a lot more smoothly than it did with when the lights are operational. But it would have to be like the last step before the beginning, before the end, you know, for martial law to be declared, especially in this day and age.
I'm guessing it's sort of like a, it's a switch that if you flip it, it's going to be hard to flip it back, if totally impossible to flip it back once you do that.
Definitely difficult. Yeah, definitely difficult. It's, you know, I'm trying to think, like, where else in our nation's history did we come that close? I mean,
9/11. I mean
9/11.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's a great example, because martial law wasn't declared in New York City. It was like, stay away from this area because it's dangerous. We have this cordoned off. Because it's investigate, you know, we're investigating, there's fires, this and that. But like the city wasn't on shutdown or any crap like that.
No, but it does feel like, because the military at that point, like, I remember 9/11, and even in Hurricane Sandy, I mean, the National Guard comes in and there's military helicopters everywhere, and there's Humvees everywhere.
Yeah.
So Katrina. Even if law enforcement, if law enforcement, local law enforcement can't, you know, provide the services in an emergency situation, you do, National Guard, the U.S. government, they definitely step in. So would that curtail martial law? Probably at some point, yeah. If law enforcement, you know, threw their hands up and said we can't deal with whatever's going on, you know, at the state level, the National Guard or the federal level, they probably would step in. I remember after 9/11, I was still working in Newark PD at the time, and I mean there's jets flying overhead, there's military helicopters. I mean, it felt like you're in a war zone. And so obviously the NYPD, or not to knock the NYPD, they're one of the best law enforcement agencies in the nation. But I mean, this is a, you know, incredible terrorist attack that no law enforcement agency, especially in 2001. Was able to handle. So we do have these, I guess we do have like these, if one agency can't handle it, a larger agency can handle it, or a federal agency can handle it. There are these safeguards, maybe, I like to think. So I can sleep at night.
Because the Office of Emergency Management needs to, you know, contact the mayor's office, let the mayor know. And I think only the governor could call in a National Guard from what I understand. So,
yeah.
That's why I hated the movie Hatchet, you know, like Hatchet 2 or whatever. It was just really horrible. And like the town sheriff's calling in the National Guard. I'm like, I don't think so, man. I need the National Guard. No, you don't.
Again, it goes back to like that bureaucracy that you see in government, where like one municipality or city, like they don't want to admit that they need the help that they need, and they're reluctant to call in the federal government. You see a lot of that, unfortunately, but. There's re-elections and there's campaign, you know what I mean? So, you know, it's just the government.
Yeah. Well, I remember with Hurricane Katrina, and I thought I'd never see it. It was so bizarre. You know, they had, you know, National Guard was out and everything else, but there were also Mexican soldiers who had also volunteered and came out to lend a hand. It was, you know, I never thought I'd see that.
Right. You know, I would think any sort of martial law would definitely be localized to specific neighborhoods. I don't think you'd ever see it on any wide scale level. It would be local neighborhoods. And I'm sure it did happen, especially Katrina, you know, where, you know, certain neighborhoods, they're either inaccessible or, you know, the response would be so slow by emergency services that, local people probably took up the service, you know, probably took the role of emergency services. I'm sure that happened.
Yeah.
You know, probably not have.
So. Oh, man.
Yeah.
All right. Why? And suddenly it's silent.
Well, Billy, is that the red light saying it's time for us to wind it down?
I don't know. I guess unless Paul, you have any other thing you want to add?
No, I guess that's it. You know, I hope I answered everything. You know, every question that you guys have, I hope it was informative. You know, I totally understand. I'm here to tell you, as a law enforcement professional, I totally understand the way scripts have to be written and movies have to be made, where, you know, corners have to be cut and everything can't be followed according to plan. You know, and maybe every profession, medical profession, or the military, you know, hopefully they feel the same, because I'm sure they watch movies and, you know, and point something out that's incorrect, you know. So, but I give leeway. I understand it, you know. So,
well, I remember.
If I can, I hope everybody else does.
I remember when we were shooting your first short film, Stable. Mm-hmm. The first thing, it's about hostage negotiator. In a church, and he's right next to, you know, he's standing in front of like an armed, you know, person.
Right.
And
complete bullshit tactics.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, the first thing, you know, as soon as we set up the scene, the first thing Paul says to me is, in real life, this would never happen.
Was a long discussion that we had. It was a long discussion with other people that worked on the film.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we really did it for logistical reasons. But no, it's total bullshit police tactics. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, so if you had a hostage, like a negotiator with an armed subject, they might be in close proximity, but would they be sitting inside a church, you know, talking to each other a couple pews away? Probably not. No, probably not.
You know, this just reminded me one last question because see it all the time. Somebody takes a hostage, you know, it's like, put down your gun, cop, you know, and the cop puts his gun down or her down. You're like, that's, you're not trained to do that, right? You're like.
Never give up your weapon.
Exactly.
No, never give up your weapon.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to hear. Bam. So get that right in your scripts, man.
You never give up your weapon.
No.
Man, I've seen that a lot.
Yeah, and you're supposed to, because I remember in that police academy I was at, I remember the assistant DA, who was actually later on murdered by someone she had convicted. She said, it's not like the movies. You take the shot, you know, and we'll back you up. It was like, wow. It was like, yeah.
No, and as a matter of fact, that is a situational question that I was asked when I was going through the hiring process for the Department of Justice back seemingly 1,000 years ago.
Damn.
I forget where they did it. It was like a mall or an airport, but there's a, you know, a traditional hostage situation where, you know, a person's got his arm around the victim's neck with the gun to the head, and he's telling, you know, give up your gun or he's going to shoot the person. You know, what do you do? And, you know, at the time, I knew enough to say, yeah, you don't give up your weapon. You know, no matter, you know, even if the worst happens, you don't give up your weapon.
Yeah, so, man. Wow. Damn.
Yep. That's life.
That's life, and I guess that's the show.
Thank you for coming on, Paul. I got a lot out of listening to.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
It was good to finally talk to you. So yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh man. I can't thank you enough, buddy. It's been, man, we've been talking about this for a few years, so I'm glad we finally got to it. And door's always open for you, man. So if you want to come on again, you know, just feel free. Let me know.
Anytime you want to have me, whatever you think I can, add to the show, I'm there.
We'll think of more stupid questions like, do cops really eat donuts, you know, and like we'll have you on for that.
I guess the answer is yes. So.
What are you going to do? Shit. Eat the damn donut. Oh man!
I like the scene in the Mod Squad. Yeah, where I guess what is it? Giovanni Ribisi is like, what do cops do? They're sitting in a car, and then Omar Epps is like, oh, we could order some donuts. Oh, anyway,
yeah.
Okay. You want to talk about bad police procedure? That's probably a good movie to start with.
So, how do we want to do this, Johnny?
Well, I was going to say, I wanted to ask Paul, I know he is very much a phantom on social media as far as social media is concerned, but if there are any places that you would like people to know where you or your work are, Paul, and I have a quick question for you before you say that, because is there a way for me to see Stable online anywhere? Yes. Okay.
If you look at I have a YouTube page, I have a Vimeo page also.
Okay.
It's under Rolling Dark Productions.
Okay.
And Stable is on there.
All right.
But any other social media? Yeah, no, I'm not the social media guy. I'm not on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. There's no reason to go see me there, really. But I do have a short film, a crime drama, that's being screened next month at the SOMA Film Festival in Maplewood, New Jersey.
Cool.
That's March 18th. At 4:30.
Damn.
Give the name, man.
Oh, it's Chance Encounter. It's a 5-minute short. That's
awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. So I wrote the screenplay. I didn't direct it. So my partner on another film, Eric Richardson Hagens, he directed it. Did a fantastic job. The two actors that are in it did a fantastic job. I wish I could take more credit for the movie, but all I did was write it. The rest of it is on everybody else. They did such a great job with it. And like Bill said before, I do have a feature-length crime drama, Rolling Dark, it's called, that's in pre-production, slated for production later on this year.
Yes!
So, everything's going along. And
it's a great script, man. It's a great script.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. It's It's definitely a script that's close to my heart. It's one of the more, you know, the screenplays that I'm most proud of. Although I still see all the flaws in it.
But, oh, stop! You always spin, you know, gold when you write, man. Shut up.
But so we're going ahead with it, and we're gonna need all the luck that we can get. So wish us luck.
Hey, and Paul, quickly, the YouTube and the Vimeo channels, is Case 5930 also on there?
Yes, sir. That's on there too. Yep.
So if you want to see the fruit of Paul's and Billy's labors, and believe me, it's like 30 minutes really well spent, you can check that out too.
Oh, thanks,
John. Yeah, it's on there. Thank you so much, John.
No, I'm so proud to have a physical copy of that in my collection. It's pretty awesome.
Cool.
Awesome. Very cool.
So, Billy?
Yeah, people can find me at CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show, The Last Knock, which you can also get on iTunes, and also to links of wonderful writing from people like Paul J. Williams and, of course, Johnny Numb. And follow me on Twitter at Crash Palace and also Billy Crash on Instagram. Johnny.
Nice. You can find my writing in addition to Crash Palace at loudgreenbird.com, and you can also find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Num, and there are no H's in those Johnnies, even in 2018.
Damn straight. And I know I should have told Paul this before the show, but when we say goodbye, don't go anywhere.
Yeah, because okay. I always hang up the phone. So yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not going to edit that out. I don't care. But so yeah, and if you have any comments about the show, please leave them on CrashPalaceProductions.com. We'd love to hear from you. And hey, if you're making a horror film and you need a consultant for police investigative work, you know the man to contact. Just let us know.
I won't charge you. I don't charge a nickel either.
Feel Stop it. What are you doing?
What are you, feel free to.
He's a thousand an hour. A thousand an hour.
I'm here to help you.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, well, way to go there, buddy. Trying to get you a second job, but anyway. Man, this is why he's not on social media.
You know, Bill, that I think Paul and I have a lot in common.
Yeah, then again, you know, the money isn't rolling in for this show. So on that note.
Right.
All right, gentlemen, have a good night.
Take care, guys. You too.
See ya.
Bye.